This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the separatists claimed responsibility for the abduction of at least 40 candidates for parliament and local councils who defied their demands to resign.
That's Smokey Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Yaoundé. Details next. Also, the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, is in Ivory Coast today, the first day of his trip to West Africa. And a Brussels court has found a former Rwandan official guilty of genocide. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, several dozen English-speaking candidates in Cameroon's February 9th local council and parliamentary elections have resigned amid separatist threats and attacks on them and their property. Houses belonging to some of the candidates have been burnt, and the whereabouts of others are unknown. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé that in spite of the threats, destruction and abductions, the government says elections must take place as planned.
Dozens of people are visiting the Yaoundé residence of Joseph Mbandam, Vice President of Cameroon's National Assembly, the lower house of its parliament, and the opposition Social Democratic Front lawmaker from the English-speaking northwestern town of Batibu to offer condolences after his house there was torched and destroyed by separatist fighters this week. Among the visitors is 21-year-old businessman Elvis Mbu, who says he witnessed the incident and fled to Yaoundé because he and the lawmaker's relatives were threatened by separatist fighters.
They were just shooting in the air. They told us that anybody who did not respect what they said will be killed. Then they asked me, where is Bandam, where is Bandam? We saw fire everywhere. And they told us that they will come back if we go to wood.
Shortly after Ndam's residence was torched, Batibo Mayor Tanjong Frederick Tetu decided not to run for re-election, saying the security situation there, the killings and abductions, could not permit him to run. Separatist fighters have insisted on social media that they will not allow the elections to take place in the English-speaking regions they call their territory. The separatists claimed responsibility for the abduction of at least 40 candidates for parliament and local councils who defied their demands to resign. The whereabouts of some of the abducted candidates is still unknown. The separatists also acknowledged that they torched at least 6 houses of candidates who escaped to the French-speaking regions for safety and refused to resign. One such house, they say, is that of Donatus Njong, mayor of the English-speaking town of Kumbu. Njong did not bow to separatist pressure to resign and escaped from Kumbu to the French-speaking region. Amid the tensions and threats, the opposition Social Democratic Front and the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement of President Paul Biya have announced that at least 27 candidates for the elections have resigned. Maurice Tangem, candidate for parliament in the English-speaking town of Mbengui, is among those who have resigned. He says he does not believe elections can be successful under the prevailing security situation in the English-speaking regions.
Considering the failure by the President of the Republic to create an enabling atmosphere for such elections, considering the ongoing extrajudicial killings in the Anglophone regions, I now officially withdraw from the said elections, which will be nothing but a sham, if there at all, hold amid prevailing circumstances.
Cameroon's Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganje says in spite of the threats, the elections will still take place. He says they have improved security in the crisis zones, and he is calling on the population to collaborate with the military and the administration by reporting suspected separatists in their towns and villages.
In the northwest and southwest, the head of state has given firm instructions that we have to do everything for these elections to hold properly. The security services must protect the electorate, protect those who are going to vote, protect the system, and protect all the structures put in place to conduct free and fair elections.
Separatists have been fighting since 2017 to detach English-speaking North, West and South West Cameroon from the rest of the country and its French-speaking majority. The government, from September 30 to October 4, organized what it called a grand national dialogue to solve the crisis. The dialogue asked for a special status for the two English-speaking regions with elected presidents and vice presidents and additional powers given to mayors, but the separatists rejected the proposed special status, saying they want nothing but an independent state. The crisis has killed at least 3,000 people and displaced over 500,000, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
French President Emmanuel Macron is in Ivory Coast today, the first day of his trip to West Africa. He starts the trip with a bit of celebration, but then will be looking at security issues in the Sahel region. My colleague, Kate Pond-Dawson, spoke with journalist Catherine Field in Paris about Macron's trip and the message he plans to share.
The start of his visit is very much focused on French troops, and then he's going to be landing in Abidjan and going straight to a base where French forces are based. Of course, France has got two bases in Africa, Abidjan and Djibouti. A lot of French troops who are based on the African continent will be traveling there and having a sort of pre-Christmas dinner with the French president and the French president's wife. This is really a signal to the troops that he is standing alongside them. Also, while he's in Abidjan, he's going to be focusing on small areas that he feels that are nevertheless important, such as youth and sports programs. He will then, on Saturday, be going into the interior of the country, having a look around there, and then again on Sunday he will be going to Bouaké, again Côte d'Ivoire, inland, an area where French soldiers were killed back in 2004, and again we're going to be seeing him looking at the economy, visiting a new market there which France is going to be funding, having a look at what sort of absolute infrastructure projects France can get involved with there. And then finally, on Sunday, we're going to be seeing him go to Niger. He's going to be in Niamey for 3 hours. And during that time, again, the focus will be G5 Sahel security, looking at what sort of facilities are there for getting more effectiveness from the troops that are based in the Sahel region.
Now, security in the Sahel has really been a problem, particularly over the last few months. We've seen hundreds of people killed in attacks by militants, including some French troops who have died in their role there. What is the president going to bring to offer?
Several points for his visit over the weekend. One is he wants to reinforce the message that France is there for the long term, but it's there for the long term as a military assistance partner, not as a sort of neo-colonial presence. So he's going to say, yes, we will be there, we'll be honoring our commitments to try and bring some sort of stability to the Sahel region. What he wants, though, in return, is he wants all those G5 nations to publicly state their support for having a French presence in the region. He is very keen, the French president, to move away from this idea that France is there in its colonial capacity. He wants that public show of support from all of the G5 nations.
Now, recently, the French military chief of staff was quoted as saying that the next year, 2020, is crucial for security in the Sahel. Why is that? What's the concern there?
The concern there is that on the one side, You're not getting enough funding from various nations in Europe and elsewhere for the whole G5 Sahel training side and also for some of the development issues there. So he's saying you've got to get this on the ground. It's crucial. This is now the time. Also, he's saying it's crucial because France cannot do this job on its own, and it needs other nations within Europe to step up and particularly to bring troops in, to give troops. We've got some support coming from the United States and some sort of air support and logistics from the United Kingdom. But France is saying, look, you know, we can't do this on our own. It's going to drag out. And he feels, particularly, the Chief of Defense Staff says, it's got to be done next year. This is not an easy job. When we've seen some of the gains that jihadists have made on the ground and some of the attacks that they've carried out quite successfully on some of the G5 nations' troops, he does feel that, you know, it is slipping away and something needs to be done or else they're just going to get bogged down for even longer.
That was reporter Catherine Field in Paris speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. For the first time in Brussels, court has found a former Rwandan official guilty of genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi. Fabien Nartis, who was the director of the national coffee promoter, Osir Cafe, may face a life sentence. Genocide survivors say they are happy that the country that had a role in the genocide can now render justice. Eugène Wimana has more from Kigali.
That's judging the Palace of Justice in Brussels. She's reading a verdict convicting 71-year-old agricultural scientist of genocide for 11 killings in Rwanda. Judge says the accused, Fabien Nyeretse, is guilty of genocide and war crimes he committed in Kigali, Gitarama, and the Ruhengeri provinces. For genocide survivors, this is an achievement in their 25-year search for justice. Jamukulu Fesite is the president of Ibuka Memoire et Justice, an umbrella organization of genocide survivors. Felicita says, even if this verdict doesn't resurrect anyone, it's a great relief for survivors, our relatives, where they are, see that we have not forgotten. Fabien Nyeretse was a cadre in the former MLND ruling party of the late president Juvenal Habyarimana. He was arrested in France in 2011. Throughout the trial, he denied both his role in the killings and the genocide. He said there was a double genocide in Rwanda. His critics say the conviction fights genocide denial. Kalongozi André Martin was defending survivors. Martin says the amazing thing is that the genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi is upheld as a crime and accept the other perpetrator who denied it since the beginning until the end of this trial. In 1994, the death of President Habyarimana in a plane crash sparked massive slaughter of ethnic Tutsis, other minorities and moderate Hutus by members of the Hutu majority. In 100 days, more than 800,000 people died and hundreds of thousands were displaced. United Nations and Belgian peacekeepers in the country did little to stop the killing and along with the French forces have been blamed for how long it went on. This decision indicates Belgium's political will to try genocide suspects. Charles Michel, former Belgian Prime Minister, now President of the European Council, has apologized on behalf of his country for not stopping the atrocities in its former colony.
Il faut le dire, ce génocide est aussi l'échec.
He says, we have to say it. That genocide is also the failure of the international community that did not prevent, didn't stop this crime against humanity. Michel says he stands for a country that needs to openly assume its responsibility in that history. Belgium has already held 4 trials and convicted 8 perpetrators of killings in Rwanda, but Nyeretse is the first defendant to be specifically convicted of the gravest charge, genocide. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The United Nations is urgently appealing for $34 million to provide life-saving support over the next 4 months for more than 250,000 people in Lesotho suffering from severe food shortages. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Lesotho is a small, landlocked country bordered by South Africa. The mostly rural population is almost entirely dependent on agriculture for its income. When the rains stop, so do the crops. The country is in the grips of a severe drought. The United Nations reports 500,000 people, one quarter of Lesotho's population, is facing hunger. It says this year's poor harvest is putting many lives at risk, with some 71,000 people just one step away from famine. Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs spokesman Jens Laerke says the UN appeal aims to help half of the affected population survive this critical period.
The relief planned in the flash appeal include food and cash assistance, ensuring clean water in priority locations such as health facilities and schools, vaccinations to prevent disease outbreaks or spread of diseases, rehabilitation of water points and preparing for the next planting season, and nutritional interventions for malnourished children, pregnant women, and people living with HIV.
He notes Lesotho has the second highest HIV prevalence rate in the world at 25.6%. Ministry of Health data show an increase in cases of severe acute malnutrition. It finds children under age 5, expectant and lactating mothers, people living with HIV, and those infected with tuberculosis are particularly vulnerable to malnutrition. As the drought worsens, Laerke tells VOA, the number of people migrating in search of work is expected to increase.
One particular concern with those movements are that makes particularly women and children, girls in particular, very vulnerable to sexual exploitation and abuse. That is, of course, in and of itself deplorable and made even worse when the HIV prevalence rates are as high as I just mentioned.
Laerke says the flash appeal includes money for protection programs to try to prevent women and girls from putting their lives and well-being at risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe's socio-economic challenges are driving thousands across the border, including scores of children who are being smuggled by organized syndicates. But these kids aren't looking for jobs, just reunions with their parents. Sadi Gando has more on the story.
Following state media reports that South African and Zimbabwean immigration officials caught 8 people in a dragnet against child smuggling along the border, VOA has been able to establish that 179 children were involved in the operation, which has been running since December 1. Immigration officials say this trend is bound to continue, especially during the holidays, with Zimbabwe in the middle of an economic crisis that has driven many people to seek jobs outside the country. The country's chief immigration officer, Respect Gono, speaks on the matter.
The main reason is, like I said, parents do not have proper documentation for them to come back to Zimbabwe. They settled in South Africa, but they don't have the proper documentation to come back to visit their families. At the end of the day, they end up having the children traveling to South Africa.
Gona feels that despite the desire for family reunions, entrusting their children to cross-border smugglers known as Omalaicha is risky business.
In the majority of cases, you would find that they are prone to accidents. The other time, one Malaicha took children from the river because they used illegal entry points. So they used an illegal entry point. The Malaicha then saw the police from across the South African side, and he literally left the car, and the car rolled down into the river. And you can imagine, all the children died. This is an incident that happened some 2 years ago.
While state media reports that most of the intercepted children come from Bulawayo, Harare, and Chiredzi, observers say the Matabeleland region is traditionally the biggest catchment zone. Observers say this form of child smuggling is bound to continue because, unlike trafficking, it is happening with the full collusion of parents and other guardians. Gono concurs.
In this particular case, the parents will assist the trafficker to take the children across. They will pay them a certain fee. I'm not sure of the figures offhand.
It's a risky yet lucrative business for the Omalaicha. Reports say they ferry goods and people illegally across the border, often in collusion with officials at both borders, charging up to 2,000 rands per child. Social commentator Effie Ncube says unemployment and poverty drive the child smuggling, but lack of documentation is a major contributor.
It is extremely difficult to get documentation in Zimbabwe. You have to wake up, even for a birth certificate, you have to wake up at 3, at 2, at 12, at midnight, just to queue for those documents, especially when you are living in these cities. And onwards, to get an ID becomes very difficult. Even more difficult is to get a passport. And that is contributing to the number of people that are crossing borders illegally out into South Africa, Botswana, and other countries. So it would be...
Bakizanani Dube is a one-time cross-border jumper from Plumtree in the Matabeleland South region.
I think the government has a lot of responsibility to be in this whole process, because they are the ones whose are skewed. The processes of getting documents are very hard and therefore unfriendly to the local communities who want to process the documents for their children as fast as possible. And also it's they bear another responsibility because they are failing to run this economy, which leads to people running away and settling in the diaspora.
Observers say migration is a global phenomenon, but administrative failures and inadequacies on the part of the Registrar General's office in Zimbabwe compound the problem. The Ministry of Home Affairs recently announced that Zimbabwe in the diaspora could secure passports for their children for $318, but that's way too expensive for those barely eking out a living, especially when the cost is about $30 in Botswana and South Africa. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
The World Health Organization today said health officials in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have documented the first relapse in the current Ebola epidemic. DRC authorities reported that an Ebola survivor in North Kivu province had fallen ill with the virus again in early December. The WHO says this is the first relapse in the outbreak, which began in 2018 and has infected more than 3,000 people in the DRC. Such relapses are rare with Ebola. 11 new Ebola cases were confirmed in the past week, and WHO officials say those patients appear to have caught the virus from the person who relapsed. This news comes just a day after the United States Federal Drug Administration gave its full approval to an Ebola vaccine produced by drug maker Merck. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clottey, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of The Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee it.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.